The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. So good morning. It's nice to see a lot of familiar faces here. I've been thinking a little bit about one thing I wanted to talk this morning. And one is that I feel touched by, I feel motivated by the realization that the goal of Buddhist practice, happiness, ease, peace, well-being, freedom, liberation, all these goals are also related to the means in which we practice. We practice by cultivating happiness, well-being, peace, ease, freedom. I like this idea that we don't have to wait till some big bang happens and then we find some peace and ease. Instead, we find it along the way as part of our practice. And not only do we find it along the way as part of our practice, but it can be part of what directs our practice. It can be part of what influences us and guides us and lets us know if we're going in the right direction. So in this way, kind of Buddhist practice can be about going towards greater ease, which is different than going towards what's easy, right? Sometimes what's easy doesn't bring us ease. So we have to make some of this distinction as we go. But when we talk about ease, we can talk about it in two ways, that in which we find in the body, some ease in the body, and some ease in the mind. Of mental states. And those activities that, of course, that bring more well-being are to be pursued and cultivated. And those that don't are not to be pursued and not to be cultivated. Right? This isn't rocket science. We know this for so many other things in our lives. If we want to learn to swim, we practice swimming. If we want to learn the piano, we practice the piano. So in the same way, if we want to learn happiness, we practice with happiness or ease. But this division between what to cultivate and what not to cultivate, what to pursue, what not to pursue, can be thought of, I often think of as kind of the fundamental practice in the Buddhist practice. It's like, how do we know what to do? How do we know what activities to do or to not do? And part of the practice is discovering this, what leads to more ease, what doesn't, what leads to suffering, what leads to the end of suffering. Part of the practice is to discover that. And then also part of the practice is to put what we've learned from that discovery into practice. Once we discover, like, oh, this actually ends up causing some suffering. It's a subtle type of suffering, but it's suffering nonetheless. Then we know that that's not the way that's going to bring the end of suffering, right? If we want to end a suffering, we don't cultivate suffering. And so one way that I've explored this a little bit in my meditation practice is I read this in a book like years ago, and it really stuck with me, this idea of like how to know if there's some grasping, some tightness, suffering, quote-unquote, some unease during meditation, is to examine what happens when the bell rings. Is there a sense of, oh, finally, okay, I made it to the end. Then that's a kind of an indicator that, okay, there's a little bit of tightness. Can you practice in a way that such that when the bell rings, you just notice, and like, okay, there's the end of the bell. And I'm going to transition to paying awareness more to what's out there rather than what's in here, as opposed to a sense of relief when the bell rings. I've done my fair share of meditating, kind of like in my mind, cursing the person who was supposed to ring the bell. Ring the bell, please. Have some compassion. You know, so there was a kind of like this really tightness, holding on for dear life kind of idea. Right, and sometimes that's all that's available for us. Right, I don't want to say that that's completely wrong or don't do it. Because sometimes that's just what's arising, and that's the reality of the moment. But I just would like to offer that there can be a way in which we approach our meditation practice that there is some ease, there's some softness, as opposed to a really striving, a tightness, I got to accomplish something, I got to make something happen, I got to manufacture, engineer, manipulate, create, you know, this kind of energy. Instead, can we have a certain amount of softness to it? So this way of going towards ease and going towards unease, the end of suffering, more suffering, kind of the, what you probably wouldn't be surprised if there are some lists, right, associated with this. But there's this word that I actually really like the way it sounds, and it also, I think it has a nice meaning. And I think underlies so much of the Buddhist practice, and we see this sprinkled throughout the Buddhist teachings, and that is this idea of kusala and akusala. I just like the way that sounds, kusala. So kusala is, we can think of it as related to both actions and mental activities. Often when it refers to actions, it gets translated as skillful. Things that are kusala or skillful are things that are help us go towards a goal, help us have an end point. Like in the Buddhist suttas, we hear a kusala sometimes referred to a potter, somebody who knows how to make pots, or a basket weaver or something like this. But it's also applied towards those who have meditation practice, as well as the Buddha himself described himself as somebody who's having kusala. But also kusala can be about mental states. You know, so not only what we're doing, our activities, how we behave, but what activities we have, what states we have in our minds. And when kusala refers to that, it's often translated as wholesome. You know, that which is not going to give rise to things that cause harm to either ourselves or to others. So kusala means skillful and wholesome. Some translators also use the word good. You know, just kind of this generic word, kind of encapsulate both of that. It's also, you know, throughout the years, the suttas have been translated into English, we see a number of different words, but primarily these ones, skillful, wholesome, good. And then, of course, akusala is the opposite. In Pali, just like in English, sometimes you put the letter A in front of a word to negate it. So akusala is unskillful, unwholesome, ungood, more formally known as bad. So there's the Buddha talks about this in a passage when he's talking to his followers, and he gives this instruction. Abandon what is akusala. So abandon what is unskillful or unwholesome. It is possible to abandon what is akusala. If it were not possible, I would not say to you, abandon what is akusala. If this abandoning of what is akusala led to harm and suffering, I would not tell you to abandon it. But because abandoning it leads to benefit and happiness, I say to you, abandon what is akusala, what is unskillful, what is unwholesome. And then, not surprisingly, the opposite, right? Cultivate what is kusala, what is skillful, wholesome. It is possible to develop or cultivate what is kusala. If it were not possible, I would not tell you to do this, to cultivate it. And if this cultivation led to harm and suffering, I would not tell you to cultivate it. But this cultivation of kusala leads to benefit and happiness. Therefore, I say to you, cultivate what is kusala. For me, in some way, this kind of summarizes the Buddha's teaching so much, right? This idea of suffering and the end of suffering. He's saying, cultivate those things that go to benefit and happiness. Abandon those things that lead to harm and suffering. We don't need formal teachings to tell us this. I think we already know, right? This is true in our lives. We experience this. But for me, I find actually a little encouragement or... I'm not exactly sure what the word is. Maybe I'll use that word encouragement. That it feels so familiar, this teaching. It's not something, we're not being asked to do something that seems very strange or counterintuitive or anything like that. Like, we already know this for our lives. So what are some of the descriptions that are given for, like, what is skillful, what is wholesome? So there's a story in the suttas of a village woman was harmed. And some of the other religious practitioners, those who were not followers of the Buddha, started spreading rumors that it was, oh, those people who follow the Buddha, they were the ones who harmed this woman. So there was an inquiry into this, like, is this really what happened? Not exactly sure why, but the king got involved in this. And the king sees Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, you know, an esteemed member of the Buddha's retinue. And the king approached Ananda. I think it was actually, you know, the king told an attendant to go talk to Ananda. You know, he didn't, you know, kings probably don't just go up and talk to regular people, maybe, but... And the king was asking about, okay, you're the Buddha, the person you're following. Would he do anything unskillful? Would he do anything unwholesome? And in that vein of that conversation, Ananda says, no, the Buddha only does what is wholesome. He only does what is skillful. And then the king asks, well, what is wholesome? What is skillful? You know, let's define the terms here. So Ananda replies to the king, right, who is not a practitioner per se, but to somebody who's in the world and has to, give laws, or maybe he doesn't give laws, maybe he just does what he wants. I'm not sure how that worked back then. But description that Ananda gives to the king is that something that is skillful is not criticized by the wise. So this idea of, like, pay attention to what other people are saying and doing. This is one indicator of whether it's wholesome or skillful. I appreciate this very much, actually. So it's not, earlier I talked about finding ease, but it can't only be just about us finding ease. It can also be like, what are other people, what would they say about this activity if they knew we were doing this? What would they say if our emails became public all of a sudden, our emails got hacked and they became public? You know, I think about these things these days, right? It seems like to be happening a lot. Make sure that, you know, there isn't any aspect of our lives that if others were to find out about it, that they wouldn't criticize us and say, why are you writing this? Why are you speaking this? Why are you saying this? So the first thing that Ananda says to the king is that it's not criticized by the wise. And maybe related to this, it's blameless. So the people wouldn't say, oh, that's, you know, look what this person did. Something else that Ananda says is that it does not bring affliction to oneself or to others. It doesn't cause harm to oneself or others. So again, kind of like looking at the influence on the community, not just on oneself. Also that it has pleasant results. So something is skillful and wholesome if the results are not troublesome. If they bring more ease, which is the next one, is that it, definition of kusala, are things that causes more wholesome states to increase and unwholesome states to decrease. That makes sense, right? So the king seemed to be satisfied with this, and based on Ananda's response, figured that, okay, the Buddha, if he has these qualities, certainly wouldn't have harmed, or he wouldn't have promoted or condoned the harm of this woman in the community. In fact, the king was so impressed that he gave a gift to Ananda. And Ananda said, but, you know, I'm a monastic. I actually have no need for these types of gifts. I kind of like this little story, a little kind of insight into how was it, what was life like back then in the time of the Buddha. But if we look at what the Buddha himself taught about what is kusala, what is wholesome, what is skillful, when he's talking to monks and nuns, practitioners, he talks about some activities. What are, you know, some specific actions to do? And there's this list, of course, right? Called the 10 skillful actions. Dasa kusala kama. Some of you may be familiar with this list. I'll just go through it kind of briefly. It starts with the usual precepts: to abstain from killing living beings, abstain from taking what is not given, abstain from sexual misconduct. And then it expands a little bit about speech. Abstain from false speech. Abstain from malicious speech. Abstain from harsh speech. Abstain from gossip. So those are some of the activities. Those are the first 7 of the skillful actions. The last 3 have to do with kind of cultivating the mental states. And that is to abstain from covetousness, you know, always like this wanting, leaning forward, and always wanting more, 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 as well as abstaining from ill will, the opposite, right, pushing away and having aversion. And then the last of these skillful actions or wholesome actions is to have right view. There's a number of ways in which we can define right views. In fact, it's defined a number of different ways in the suttas. But one way is to look at things through the perspective, through the view of the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, and there is the end of suffering. And there is the cessation of suffering, and that which leads to the cessation of suffering. So part of the skillful actions is to use this perspective, what leads to suffering, what doesn't lead to suffering. So in some ways, this, right, it's skillful to think about what is skillful. It's skillful to think about what causes harm. So we have the 10 skillful actions. It's one way that the Buddha talked about what is kusala. We also have it for maybe a little bit more for some mental factors. Did the Buddha teach what is kusala? What are some ways in which we can find peace and ease and freedom, the end of suffering? This I find a little bit amusing because I'm one of those people that actually really like the lists of the Buddha's teaching. I know some people have an aversion to this, but I like the lists because it helps me, like, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, wait, I'm missing one. What is that one? You know, it kind of helps me. So here is a list of lists. And I'm just going to list the lists. They're in numerical order. The 4 foundations of mindfulness, probably familiar with this. The 4 right efforts. I'll talk about this a little bit more. This is part of the Eightfold Path. The 4 roads to power. This is, translators really don't know how to translate this. It's not something that's very common. I've never heard it in a Dharma talk. It's kind of a little more obscure thing. 5 faculties, spiritual faculties. You're probably familiar with this or heard this. 5 powers, which are the same as the 5 faculties, just maybe supercharged or perfected or something like this. 7 factors of awakening, 7 factors of enlightenment. Maybe you've heard of this. And the Eightfold Path, the 8 factors. If you add all these numbers up, you get the number 37. And this is kind of known as the 37 wings to liberation, the 37 wings of awakening, the 37 factors to awakening. So that is, right, there's a lot in there, right? There's whole Dharma talks to some, maybe like one of these 37 things. But for me, I like this idea of we can really drill down into some, what are some of the particular items in this list? Or we could also come way up in the bird's eye view. Okay, there's skillful and unskillful. There's wholesome and unwholesome. And there can be different times in our life, different times in our practice, different times in the day, in which it makes sense to be involved with the minutiae of things, and when it makes sense to be really up on the bird's eye view. So, how do we cultivate things that are skillful and wholesome if we want to encourage to have this arise in our life and in our practice? How do we cultivate it? And also remember that was part of the teaching of the Buddha, is to cultivate what is a kusala. And one way, probably you won't be surprised, is to work on our actions, how we behave in the world, what we do. This is helpful for a number of reasons. One is if we're putting a limit on what we do, that is, if we're abstaining from killing living beings, if we're abstaining from taking that what is not given, if we're abstaining from sexual misconduct, if we're abstaining from malicious, harsh, false speech, then we're not letting the mind just go crazy. We're not just letting it run rampant in terms of that it overwhelms us and compels us to behave in an unethical, unskillful way. So by maybe with stopping with our actions, maybe we still have some of these thoughts. Maybe we are just overcome with anger, but we don't lash out and harm others. So in that way, the anger doesn't get bigger and bigger and bigger and gets expressed in a way that not only harms others, but harms us, and creates the habit in the mind to allow the anger to just get bigger. I think all of us know this, right? This idea of neuroplasticity or habits, that which we tend to do or indulge or repeatedly think about gets reinforced. But not only the number of times we think or do things, but also the magnitude, the amount of emotion, the amount of, you know, our whole experience that is involved with it contributes to that as well. So one way to work with this is to work on our actions. Let's see, I'm missing a page of my notes. Okay, it's probably on my printer. That's fine. Another way to work on this is through our mental factors, through our unwholesome, I'm sorry, to pay attention to the qualities of our mind. So even though we may not be acting out what's in our minds, the anger, confusion, sadness, in such a way that it causes harm, we may be still noticing that there's a lot of this mental states that don't support us in our minds. And so the Buddha gave some instructions on how to work with this. And one is we can look at what is underlying these mental states that are not kusala, the ones that are akusala. We can look at them and can we see what's fueling them? In the Buddhist teachings, there's these three basic defilements: greed, hatred, delusion. The thinking being that all of our unwholesome, unskillful activities and mental activities derive from one of these three. It may be, not directly related, or maybe not so obvious, how it's greed, hatred, or delusion. But if we pay attention and really explore, we will see that it has a kind of greed wanting more of something, hatred pushing away of something, or a delusion of not seeing clearly. Not seeing clearly about what's happening, or maybe like not having right view, looking through the idea of rather looking through the perspective of what's suffering and not suffering, we're looking through the perspective of what's going to make me look good, or what's going to just make me have some small amount of pleasure, even though it may not be happiness, but what's just going to make me feel more comfortable. So we can see that that's related to delusion. So some of the instructions are, if you discover that some of the unwholesome, unskillful mental states that you have is in fact related to greed or lust towards another person, he specifically says, and if you find that you can't put it down, that it's has a compulsive quality to it, then bring to mind that in fact, actually this person is a collection of body parts. It's quite something if you've ever tried this. Instead of thinking about, oh, this person is quite attractive, this is something that I often do. Like, wow, they may have nice hair, but how would I feel if that hair were in my soup? Right? It's just different. Or they have phlegm, they have a spleen, they have snot, right? You like all these things. Even just thinking about that briefly, it kind of breaks the trance of like, oh yes, this, if I just were able to be with this person in some way. So this is one way that he said towards, if we find ourselves having greed towards individuals. But what if it's not individuals that so much that we have greed towards? What if it is material objects? Then the Buddha recommended that we can reflect on the impermanent nature of objects. And impermanent nature means a few things. One is that, of course, it's going to change. I remember when I was in my early 20s, and I got a new car. My parents had given it to me as a gift. And I just loved this car, right? I was like so happy that I got this car. How long did it take before the first dent? Not very long, right? Less than a week. And then a little door ding. And like, oh my gosh, my car. But I keep this in my mind. This helps me so much to just remember like everything eventually is going to get the equivalent of a door ding. Things don't stay this pristine way. They don't stay perfect. And even if they do, like maybe not on the outside, look like that they have little door dings, they often require maintenance, right? We have to charge them, or we have to reboot them, or we have to clean them, or we have to change the batteries. I don't know, I'm just making this up. Right? It's not like it's just simple. These objects, they're complicated. We have to maintain them, they change. And of course, they break. And so just bringing to mind, because often when we have a lot of greed for things, we are thinking more about the idea of the objects. And then when we start to look like underneath the idea and start to look at the actual objects as material things, they start to lose a little bit of their luster, some of their attraction. So along with this idea of kind of, for me, I remember this so clearly, like how heartbroken I was with these first door ding. And then something that I didn't have the words back then, but now I do, it's like, oh yeah, objects are not a source of lasting happiness. This is a lesson that we have learned and we have to learn again and again. And again, I'm still learning this, right? Sometimes I feel like, oh, I'll just go into Amazon.com and I'll buy this and everything will be fine, right? I need this thing and it'll solve this problem and then everything will be set. Right? It's this kind of subtle thinking that I have in the back of my mind. It's a little bit crazy. Right? I know that objects don't make me happy. They're not a source of lasting happiness. But still, I sometimes have this, you know, want to acquire things, acquire objects. There's nothing wrong with purchasing things that support our lives, bring benefit to our lives, help us, help others. We get into trouble if we think that they're going to be a source of happiness, lasting happiness. They may be sources of a certain amount of pleasure in the moment, maybe pleasure more than a moment. But the Buddha is encouraging us to keep this in mind. When we find that what's fueling some unwholesome thoughts or unwholesome activities is greed, if it's greed for a person, just remember they're made up of parts. And if it's for objects, we can remember that it's impermanent and they will change and they're not a source of happiness, lasting happiness. And then what if it's not greed that's fueling our unwholesome thoughts or ideas, but it's more aversion? And so for aversion towards people, if we're filled with resentment, if we're filled with anger, if we're filled with ill will, hostility, a practice we can do to counteract that is to practice loving kindness. It doesn't have to be loving kindness towards the person that we have the anger or hostility towards. It's the act of practicing loving kindness, that is, wishing goodwill, wishing friendliness. I've heard somebody describe it as sending good vibes. To anybody. It could be whoever it's easiest to send it to. It could be somebody that has benefited you a lot in your life and somebody that you have so much respect for and care for and that it's easy for you. You just naturally feel kindness and loving kindness towards them. This may be somebody you've never met. This may be a religious leader. It may be, for some people, also it may even just be a pet. So to practice loving kindness to whomever can help counteract hostility, ill will to whomever. We don't have to practice the loving kindness towards that particular person. That's asking a lot. It's possible we can do it, but often that requires a real settledness of the mind in order to do it, send loving kindness to precisely that person we have hostility towards. Instead, I often am just cultivating loving kindness in general. And it's often easiest towards somebody I have a lot of respect and care and love for. And then I just notice that hostility just naturally softens, just naturally goes away. So this was the Buddha's teaching on what to do if you find your unwholesome thoughts are directed towards a person. If you find that you have aversion towards inanimate objects, to material things, maybe similar to how if you have lust for a person, you'll consider or contemplate or imagine their body parts. If you have aversion to material objects, you can consider, oh, this is just made up of elements. Again, kind of break it apart. Oh, yeah, I love this car, but well, what is it that you're in love with the car? Is it the steering wheel? Is it the engine? Is it the paint? Is it the smell? Is it the radiator? Is it the accelerator? Right, just to notice that car is also a concept that we're applying to this big collection of parts. And somehow when we examine or bring to mind or remind ourselves that these things are actually made of parts, it breaks a little bit the trance we have towards them. So it's sort of breaking apart. I was talking about, am I in love with? This is for if you have aversion towards. So is it that you could do this for if you're in love with a car as well, but it could also be for aversion. Is it the smell? Is it the steering wheel, the radiator, the accelerator, exhaust pipe? There's lots of parts in a car. To bring it more to like tangible, direct experience, as opposed to a concept of something. But let's say that you're discovering that your unwholesome states in your mind are not based on greed, not based on aversion, but are something else. For me, I use this kind of delusion as that third bucket. Because often, I don't feel like it's greed or hatred, I feel like maybe it's just delusion. And one way to practice with this is to investigate what's really going on here. You can investigate your experience at that moment, your direct experience. You can investigate the teachings. Like, well, what are they really trying to say? What's the message here? You can investigate the teachings by, of course, reading Dharma books, going to Dharma talks, talking to friends that you have in the practice community, talking to a teacher, having a practice discussion, talking with a mentor. Here at IMC, we have the mentoring program for the Eightfold Path program, which I believe starts up in the fall again. So if we find that what's fueling our unwholesome states is not greed or hatred, maybe it's delusion. Maybe it's not seeing things clearly. Maybe it's not seeing ourselves clearly. Just like we can look at other people and at material objects and break them up and see that they're actually a collection of parts, maybe we could do the same when we examine ourselves. We are a collection of parts also, in so many different ways. The obvious ones, right, is a kind of dichotomy that I made in this talk, the body and the mind. So if we feel like we have to prop up ourselves, defend ourselves, make ourselves look good to others, protect ourselves, we can examine, well, what is it exactly? Are we protecting? I know this sounds a little bit silly, but is it our elbows? Is it our hip bones? Is it the sad feeling I had yesterday? Is it the hostility I'm feeling at this moment? You know, we could just examine and see that, in fact, we are a collection of parts too. And that can, some part of our delusion often is holding ourselves as a constant entity that needs to be protected and bolstered and propped up. So some of you may have recognized that, so I've been talking about cultivating kusala, skillful actions, wholesome mental states, and that in fact, the part of the Buddhist practice, I would say, so much of it is this bird's eye view of knowing what is it that we want to cultivate and not cultivate. Maybe we could like summarize all of the Buddhist practice in this way. What leads to suffering? What leads to the end of suffering? And as I said earlier, the more we practice, the more we learn, we can discover, oh yeah, there's some subtle greed there, there's some subtle aversion there that I didn't notice. Maybe I'll end with this. So some of you may have noticed that this idea of cultivating kusala is actually the third of the four great endeavors. I like this expression, great endeavors. It makes me feel important. It's four great endeavors. Right effort, which is the sixth factor in the Eightfold Path. For those of you who are familiar with the Eightfold Path, the sixth one, number six, is right effort. Right effort is defined as prevent a kusala. Abandon any akusala that has arisen. Cultivate kusala. That's what I've been talking about. And when kusala has arisen, maintain it. So if we were to explore this, we could go look into the details of how to prevent and abandon, cultivate and maintain. But maybe it's not surprising that so much of the way that we cultivate kusala, we can also use the same skills and the same approach to help us abandon akusala. But maybe I'll add this one bit about abandoning or preventing akusala as skillful and wholesome. One is avoid, just simple avoidance. Maybe this means not going down the cookie aisle at the grocery store if you don't want to be buying cookies, right? It's pretty straightforward. But just to know, like, okay, this is, I have a sensitivity here. I'm just going to not to create the conditions in which I have to use my maximum amount of willpower or something like this. I'm going to try to set up my life in such a way that supports me not having to say no, 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 but in a way that I can find, yes, there's some ease here. So in this way, cultivating kusala, cultivating what is skillful, cultivating what is wholesome, finding ease, finding peace, finding well-being, finding freedom and liberation can be the means of our practice, can help direct how our practice goes. And it's also the fruit or the goal of practice too. Find freedom and liberation. So I wish for all of you that you have moments of skillfulness and wholesomeness that you acknowledge and notice, and that you can learn how to cultivate so you can experience peace and ease and happiness. Thank you.